This is Web Talk Guys Radio, and thank you for listening today. And my name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. And together, Rob and I are committed to shining a little flashlight into the future of the internet for you.
Yes, and making it a little brighter for us all. We would like you to sign up for our newsletter at our website at webtalkguys.com. And we usually send out an email about once a month. We offer this newsletter as a little extra something to give a little information there about what we're doing on the show every week.
A couple of fascinating people are joining us today. Each, in their own way, are using the internet to make a difference in our future.
We'll first talk with Andrew Butler from the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and we're going to talk about how PETA at PETA.org is using the internet to reach out and further the cause of animal rights, and he is PETA's campaign coordinator.
By using the internet, we're able to convey an enormous amount of information very quickly and at little expense. It's also an extremely good way to convey information that otherwise would be seen as too shocking or too graphic to convey using conventional means. We certainly try to advertise using the radio, television, and billboards, but the sort of abuse we seek to expose is so shocking and so brutal that many stations won't actually air this sort of footage, but people are more willing to actually take a look at that, we've found, if they find this on the internet and if they can look at it on their own terms.
After PETA, we're inviting internet visionary Howard Rheingold to shine an even brighter light into the future of the internet. Howard believes that the web is changing the face of human interaction. Nothing small there. And he recently authored a new book on the subject called Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution.
I first noticed young people in places like Japan looking at their telephones more than they were listening to them. That's this text messaging. When I looked into what these teenagers were doing, I was told, and this was curious, that the adults were using the term flocking to describe the way teenagers all show up at the same place at the same time from eight different directions because they've coordinated through these messages. In the Philippines, over 1 million Philippine citizens had demonstrated peacefully and had in fact brought down the corrupt Estrada regime, all organized by text messages. I realized that there was a connection here, and the Smart Mob really grew out of that, the idea that people are now able to coordinate their activities, even if they don't know each other, you know, a basis of a group of teenagers or 1 million citizens in ways that they weren't able to before.
This is a fascinating conversation, and it's very timely with all of the wireless news that's been coming out this past week. All that ahead here on Web Talk Guys Radio.
Do you have a website that's feeling a little lonely? Well, you might need a good dose of marketing and promotions. Come join the Web Talk Guys at a one-day workshop, March 18. We'll help you understand the successful components of a marketing plan for an e-business, and we'll also cover sponsored links, search engine optimization, submission and ranking, reciprocal links, building an affiliate program, newsletters, the media, usability, and all kinds of techniques. The workshop is held at the Tacoma Community College's Downtown Center in Tacoma, Washington, and it runs from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Tuesday, March 18. To find out more information, visit the Web Talk Guys website at webtalkguys.com/workshop. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
We're back, and you're plugged into the Web Talk Guys radio show, where you can always count on hearing the latest in what's happening on the internet. And my name is Rob Greenlee, and I've got Web Girl Dana here on the other mic. Animals have always had a place on the net, and it's usually around sites that have pets up there and talk about nature. Today we're going to be talking about a very controversial site about animals, and it's PETA.org, and this is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and they are using the internet to further their cause and to teach people about how animals are being mistreated around the world and how we can all have a kinder and gentler relationship with all living beings on Earth.
PETA recently launched a new website. It's called PETA2.com, and that appeals to Generation Y. That's the ages of 13 through 24. So joining us on the phone right now to talk about PETA and the new site and how they use the internet to reach out and further the cause of animals is Andrew Butler. He's PETA's campaign coordinator.
Andrew, thank you for joining us today.
That's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Rob, and thank you, Dana.
For those that are unfamiliar with PETA, why don't you tell us a little bit about the background and kind of what the organization is all about? I know a lot of people have heard things, but why don't you clear the air and let all of our listeners know what PETA is about?
Well, PETA are an international animal rights organization, and in fact, we're the largest rights organization in the world. And we operate under a very simple principle that animals are not ours to eat, wear, experiment on, or use for entertainment. And the issues we work on, we work through public education, through undercover investigations, and really just trying to draw people's attention to the behind-the-scenes abuse that animals suffer in the food industry, the clothing industry, behind the closed doors of laboratories and in entertainment.
And certainly don't forget pet shops.
Absolutely, yes. We have quite a large domestic animal abuse and investigation department, which deals with all sorts of issues relating to cats, dogs, and other domesticated animals. We work on cruelty cases across the country, and those include instances of cruelty at pet shops and puppy mills. But we also have quite a significant local effort here in Virginia, in Norfolk, Virginia, where our international headquarters are, to provide things like free dog houses and straw for backyard dogs who really have no protection from the elements.
Why don't you run down, Andrew, some of the facts? I think that education is probably the most important thing for people out there. They don't understand or know what a slaughterhouse is like, or how many animals do die in the United States, or I don't know if you have worldwide statistics. Why don't you share some things that you do know?
Sure. I think the most important and basic thing for people to bear in mind is that animals are flesh and blood just like we are, that they feel pain in much the same way as we do. And although we can empathize and understand acting compassionately towards the cats and dogs and other animals that are close to us, we don't really see what happens to the animals that we serve at dinner, or the animals that we wear. And really it's that hidden abuse, that hidden cruelty that PETA seek to expose, and to show that the cows, the pigs, the chickens, and the other animals that we slaughter for our plate certainly have the same capacity to feel pain and to suffer as the cats and dogs we share our homes with. And we conduct undercover investigations. We go behind the scenes at farms, and what we find time and time again is animals being viciously abused above and beyond they're being raised in the usual manner. We find piglets being beaten to death with hammers. We found sows having concrete blocks dropped on their head and then their throat slit and skin peeled back, all while still fully conscious. We find that at slaughterhouses, animals are fully conscious when they're strung up by their hind legs, when they have their throat slit, and when they're dismembered. These sort of abuses are a matter of course. They're routine. And the way that we raise animals is very intensive. We confine them in filthy conditions. We mutilate them through things like tail docking and tooth pulling. And this is what you're buying into every time you sit down to a meat-based meal. And our goal is simply to open people's eyes to these sorts of abuses, to get people to realize that animals suffer abysmally, and that we all have the power to actually change that. And we do that by adopting a vegetarian diet or not wearing animals. These are very simple things we can all do in our everyday lives to improve the lot of animals.
Why are these things happening, do you think?
Well, they're happening based on habit and commerce, by and large. I think most people were raised eating meat and wearing animal products and going to the circus, they aren't fully aware of what goes on behind the scenes. Although I think in the back of most people's minds, they realize that there is something dirty and something disgusting about the way we treat animals that has to be kept hidden from view.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at a different aspect, the circus, for example, most people just see the happy facade of a circus. They see the clowns, they see the bright colors, but what they don't see is the behind-the-scenes footage of animals being trained. And we've seen how, in one particular instance, a trainer was showing others how to control elephants, and he was yelling to hurt them, to make them scream. Saying to them, don't come into this barn if you don't want to hurt them. And these animals are trained through force. There is not a bag of peanuts which gets them to stand on their hind legs and to perform these unnatural tricks. It's simply through instilling fear into these animals that they're forced to perform these acts for our entertainment. So it's a question of really opening people's eyes, getting people to realize that they shouldn't go to the circus, that they shouldn't be eating animal products or wearing them. Certainly, attitudes are changing around the world. Legislation is being brought to bear to outlaw certain cruel practices like fur farming, for example, which has been outlawed in the UK, cosmetic testing, which is being outlawed throughout Europe. So certainly things are changing.
Interesting that Europe seems a little bit more progressive in that department than America.
I think things are changing more quickly in Europe simply because these have been concerns in Europe for longer. It was mid-1800s when the RSPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, was formed, and people have been dealing with these issues at a legislative level ever since. But the idea of caring for animals stretches back throughout human history, from people like Pythagoras to Leonardo da Vinci to Albert Einstein. Some of our greatest thinkers and doers have been vegetarian and animal rights activists or advocates, at any rate. So certainly I think we have a long way to go, but we have come very far in a relatively short space of time.
Seems like the core issue is that people in general don't value animals as high as they value human life. And it seems like that's the issue, but it also seems like the worst abuses of animal cruelty are happening within the business environment.
Exactly. I mean, the sort of abuse that we fight is institutionalized abuse of animals. It's where animals are used as commodities, as either test tubes with tails or meat-producing, milk-producing machines. Really, we don't put animals on some kind of arbitrary sliding scale where we say this animal is more important than another or we're more important than they are. I think as soon as you start putting limits on your compassion and who you act responsibly towards, it's a very slippery and dangerous slope. And certainly when you're dealing with animals, the way that we view them is a kind of speciesism, just as slavery was allowed because of racism, just as women were not allowed the right to vote because of sexism. The way we behave towards animals, we do so because we view them as different from ourselves. What we're trying to do as an organization is just to expand people's circle of compassion, to get them to encompass acting responsibly and compassionately towards all life, regardless of race, sex, age, or indeed species.
So it sounds like what you guys are really focused on is trying to educate the world population to the issues and mm-hmm. hoping that people will realize the bad direction that we're going with how we treat animals worldwide. And that brings me back really to the World Wide Web and the Internet, and that's what this show is about. How are you using the Internet as a tool to help educate the world's population? And, you know, and we've been really impressed with your websites. And why don't you kind of run through a little bit of your philosophy of how you take your message to the Internet?
Well, I think the Internet's really revolutionized the way that we campaign and the way that we get our message out. I think first and foremost, it's a way for us to deliver our message directly to the people we're trying to reach without going through an intermediary like the media. It's also incredibly cost-effective. As a non-profit organization, our resources are somewhat limited, and by using the Internet, we're able to convey an enormous amount of information very quickly and at little expense. It's also an extremely good way to convey information that otherwise would be seen as too shocking or too graphic to convey using conventional means. We certainly try to advertise using the radio, television, and billboards, but the sort of abuse we seek to expose is so shocking and so brutal that many stations won't actually air this sort of footage. But people are more willing to actually take a look at that, we've found, if they find this on the Internet and if they can look at it on their own terms.
We have Andrew Butler on the line. Andrew's the campaign coordinator for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
You guys certainly have a lot of sites online. You know, I think we counted about 52 just within the U.S. And it seems like with the philosophy you guys are taking is very niche-oriented. You kind of take an issue and you build a site around it. Could you explain to us a little bit how that works and what kind of success you're finding with that?
Well, because we work on so many issues and we have so many independent and specific campaigns, we feel that it's very important, and it's certainly been to our benefit to create a certain brand image, if you like, surrounding each of our campaigns. And so the sort of designs you see on our websites also tie into the materials for that particular campaign. So, for example, we have a campaign at the moment against KFC asking that the corporation improve the living and dying conditions for the chickens they raise for their restaurants. Mm-hmm. So we have a website, kfccruelty.com. And if you look on that website, you will find all of our campaign materials and an explanation of that campaign. And that's certainly something that we've tried to do throughout our website.
I was visiting your website, and there's a pop-up on your front page right now that says that Burger King has initiated a veggie burger.
That's right. We're actually rewarding Burger King, if you like, for putting a veggie burger in all of its restaurants throughout the country. We actually campaigned against Burger King in much the same way we're now campaigning against KFC, and we managed to get them to implement a raft of reforms in the way that animals were treated for their restaurants, including things like stopping a practice called forced molting, where all food and water was withdrawn from laying hens for up to 2 weeks in order to shock their bodies into one last laying cycle. But part of that campaign was also to get vegetarian options into Burger King, for which there is an enormous demand. And thankfully, Burger King did that, so now we have these pop-ups every time you go to one of our websites urging people to support and give the BK Veggie a try.
You know, Andrew, you said earlier that the culture of America seems to be to hide some of the uglier issues of animal cruelty from particularly, I think, our children, because it's so wrong, because I think you never get more compassionate than when you're young.
Exactly.
And so one of the things PETA has done, and I'm really impressed, is develop a site called PETA2.org. Tell us about that and what that focuses on.
Well, PETA 2 is probably the most exciting site we have at the moment, certainly in my mind. This is a youth-oriented site, and I think you're right in saying that when it comes to hiding this sort of abuse, most people are very reticent to tell their kids exactly what they're eating. I know a lot of kids have asked, you know, what is it that I'm eating, and the parents won't let them know that it's the corpse of a once living, breathing, feeling animal. I myself am a father. I have a 6-year-old daughter, and as with most kids, she has a natural empathy for animals. And rather than try to destroy that, I've fostered that. And I think it's very important for us to instill compassion in our children. PETA 2 specifically is aimed at a slightly older age group, probably from early teens to early 20s. And it's a site that's been extremely successful. It's very upfront about its subject matter. It's very forthright in explaining the issues, but it's also a very open forum. We have message boards where people can come and discuss these issues and get advice and swap stories. And we also have a section where we encourage young people to get active for animals. We have what's called a street team, and you can join up as a member of the street team and be given assignments, things that you can do to go out and help animals, whether it's organizing a protest or veganizing your school cafeteria. And we have many thousands of members who have joined the street team and many thousands who correspond via the message board. So it's been very, very successful, and has also managed to draw a lot of people, celebrity spokespeople, to the site who appeal to that particular audience. People like Ed Templeton, Morrissey, Goldfinger, The Clips, Sum 41, Pink, NERD, and a host of others.
In fact, can you tell us some maybe a specific success story you've seen from maybe one of the street teams that they've actually, you know, one kid has been able to make a difference?
Well, I think one of the greatest things we've seen is a lot of the school cafeterias responding to requests for more vegetarian and vegan meals. So that certainly has been very successful. And we certainly know that many of our street team members have helped with the campaign against the fast food restaurants and managed to get them to implement these groundbreaking and sweeping reforms. And certainly without our activists, without our supporters who actually go out there and campaign directly for animals, we would have a very, very hard time affecting positive change. And it's been the same with every social reform movement. As Martin Luther King once said, we'll have to repent in this generation not so much for the evil deeds of the wicked people, but for the appalling silence of the good. And I think it's beholden of all of us to speak up whenever we see acts of abuse, whether they be against human or non-human animals.
One of the great things that we saw on your site is a service that you guys are offering called PETA TV, and it was very informative to watch that. Could you kind of give us a little bit of a picture of what PETA TV is all about and how successful that is?
Well, PETA TV really seeks to show our undercover investigations, for one thing, and also to show some of our PSAs. We have a great many really incredible ads that have been produced on our behalf. Many of them are very funny. We have a sexy cat ad in which some cats get jiggy, if you like, when the people leave the house in the morning. And this is a spot which asks people to be responsible, to spay and neuter their companion animals so as to not add to the overpopulation crisis which we're facing at the moment, where we see many, many thousands of animals needlessly euthanized every year. But those ads, as with the sort of footage we have, are often not broadcast on mainstream media. Yeah. In fact, even MTV banned the sexy cat ad. So if you go to PETATV.com, you can actually view some of these very interesting and informative and funny PSAs that we have.
Yeah, I would think that that's quite a juggle for you guys. I mean, it seems like you guys want to have kind of a shock treatment to get people changed in their philosophies, but at the same time, that probably gets in the way of getting a larger audience to view the content that you create. What's your thoughts on that?
It is a very tricky balance between controversy and actually compelling, but it's something that I think we've managed very well in the past. And again, it's an area where the internet has helped us enormously as a result of being able to make use of streaming media, having all of our undercover investigations and all of our videos available in RealPlayer or Windows Media or QuickTime. Mm-hmm. We are able to get that directly to people who are interested in it. And we have a website, goveg.com, where people can view a video called Meet Your Meat. And it takes you behind the scenes of farms and slaughterhouses. And we certainly know that many people have been converted to vegetarianism after watching that.
We're having a conversation with Andrew Butler, who's the campaign coordinator for PETA at PETA.org. And they are the people for the ethical treatment of animals. What are you guys seeing as far as the success of your streaming media online? Is it growing fast, or what's it doing right now? Are you guys planning on expanding that?
We are expanding that, and it's growing enormously. In fact, it's one of the fastest-growing areas of our website. And we have a new PETA TV director who previously worked at CNN, and he's doing incredible things, putting together whole packages of footage and interviews which are very professionally produced and are in the sort of format that people are used to watching. By watching current affairs programs on TV. We currently have something featuring Lauren Anderson, Playboy Playmate, who's just starred in an ad for us. And she's interviewed on there and has some incredible insights about what she found when she went to college and she went to an agricultural college and actually saw the process that animals go through when they're slaughtered, saw animals kicking and struggling for their lives as they were being slowly bled to death. And that's the sort of thing that I think that most people are compassionate. Most people don't want to see animals suffer needlessly. And if you're exposed to that, whether it be directly or via people like Lauren Anderson, I think many people will be compelled to change, to take action to end that sort of abuse.
Andrew, you talk about Lauren Anderson, and it makes me think it's an interesting balance that you've been able to strike, but I think very effective, between something as awesomely horrible as cruelty and the sort of the tongue-in-cheek, maybe a little bit sexy kind of campaigns that you run. You have a website called runningofthenudes.com. You have recently done Sexiest Vegetarians Alive, you know, a takeoff on the People magazine's little Sexiest Man Alive.
Yeah.
And I think there's a poster up on your front of your website that's Turn Your Back on Wearing Fur, right,
yeah.
And all the models that are naked.
So, well, I think we realize, just as most people who are involved in public relations know, that sex sells. And that's certainly something that we have used to our advantage. And there are so many really great celebrity supporters of PETA, from Paul McCartney to Pamela Anderson to Alicia Silverstone, and many, many more who care deeply about animals and who are vegetarian themselves. And every year we run the Sexiest Vegetarian Alive poll. Previous years have seen people like Shania Twain win it, and this last year Tobey Maguire and Natalie Portman were the ones that came out top. But within that list you had the likes of Jude Law, Thora Birch, Mos Def, Dre from Outkast, Woody Harrelson, and Drew Barrymore, many, many others. So it's certainly something that I think people respond well to. They see this, and they see that it's something that it's a sort of movement that everyone can be involved in, and it doesn't necessarily have to be all doom and gloom. Certainly vegetarian cooking has come a long way in recent years, and you can find great veggie food in every grocery store and virtually all restaurants that you go to these days.
Linda McCartney's really pushed that further. You actually had some experience working with Paul McCartney too. What was that situation?
That was actually a situation in the UK, which involved a facility that bred dogs, beagle dogs, specifically so that they could be experimented on. And these dogs were going into facilities where they were used in toxicity tests, where they were slowly poisoned to death, where these dogs were in tiny cages, convulsing, suffering from internal bleeding, etc. When Paul and Linda McCartney found out that this facility was going to be closed down through public pressure, they offered to put up the funds necessary to actually purchase those dogs so that we could save them from that situation. We managed to get over 100 dogs out of that particular facility, and I was fortunate enough to live with two of those beagles for several years. Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of an experience that allows you to realize that these animals are just like the dogs and cats that you have at home, that there isn't a special breed of dog used in laboratories that makes them any less loving or any less capable of feeling pain.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a bit about your experience over the last few months of being a spokesperson in the media, and kind of how you've been treated and how things have kind of worked out with that?
Well, I think that sadly we live in a society where we have a very short attention span, that most people get their news in sound bites, and most people need controversy in order to be entertained, even when it's part of serious news. So the sort of debates we're involved in are very adversarial, when at its core the message is a very, very simple one, simply that we should be kind and compassionate across the board, that we shouldn't limit our compassion, that we as a species have a very unique capability to make moral and ethical decisions about everything that we do, and we should all try, whenever possible, to act responsibly, to act compassionately. And there is always that option. There's always that choice. Either we can choose to be cruel, or we can choose to be kind. And as an organization, we're simply asking that people choose kindness wherever possible.
Yeah, I've heard the comment made in other media sources in relation to PETA, that PETA values animal life more than human life. How do you respond to that characterization?
Well, I think anyone who knows anything about PETA as an organization or has met anyone who works for PETA would be able to tell you that as an organization, we strive for peace every day. We strive to make the world a more compassionate place every day. And it's not about making an arbitrary sliding scale about who's more important than another. Compassion is compassion. As soon as you start meting it out based on race or sex or species, really you make a mockery of that and you water it down. So it's not about placing animals first or about placing people first, but just about acting responsibly in everything that you do.
So it is possible for animals to be used as food as long as they're treated humanely, or are you guys going all the way and saying that animals shouldn't be ever used for food?
Well, certainly as an organization, we strive for vegetarianism because not only do we not need to use animals for food, but in doing so, we're needlessly taking life and we're harming ourselves. We know that eating meat, which is loaded with saturated fat and cholesterol, clogs our arteries and leads to heart disease and many cancers. Mm-hmm. We know that 90% of cancer, in fact, is preventable through various lifestyle factors, and right at the very top of that is switching to a vegetarian diet, eliminating animal products from our diet. So it's a win-win situation for everyone. And certainly animals are there for their own means, and taking their lives simply because it's convenient for us or because we like the taste of their flesh isn't an excuse, and really is something that is easy to prevent by all of us.
Tell us about how a listener can actually find out more about PETA and get involved in PETA's movement.
The first thing to do would just be to go to our main site, PETA.org, and you can find out all about us as an organization there. There you'll also find action alerts, alerting people to very specific instances of cruelty where individuals have been shown to be torturing animals or where corporations are found to be engaged in practices that hurt animals or people. Those are very quick and simple things that people can do, which involve writing letters or making a phone call. But also, just go to our website, goveg.com. Really, that's the easiest and best thing you can do to help animals, the environment, and indeed your own health. It's an ideal starting point for people who are interested in this as an issue.
So you can find all those 52 sites off of PETA's front page?
Off of PETA.org, absolutely. there's a drop-down menu of other sites. We have a search engine within that. And basically, on that site, you'll find anything to do with any kind of animal issue.
Terrific. Hey, it was great having you on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
I definitely wish you a lot of success, Andrew, with what
you're
doing. We really support that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Dana. And thank you very much, Rob. I really do appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Andrew Butler, campaign coordinator for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Stay connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show, because up next we're going to be talking with an internet visionary. His name is Howard Rheingold, and Howard believes the web is changing the face of human contact through the use of wireless tools out there, and he's recently authored a new book on the subject called Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. You're listening to Web Talk Guys radio.
Do you have a website that's feeling a little lonely? Well, you might need a good dose of marketing and promotions. Come join the Web Talk Guys at a one-day workshop, March 18. We'll help you understand the successful components of a marketing plan for an e-business, and we'll also cover sponsored links, search engine optimization, submission and ranking, reciprocal links, building an affiliate program, newsletters, the media, usability, and all kinds of techniques. The workshop is held at the Tacoma Community College's Downtown Center in Tacoma, Washington, and it runs from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Tuesday, March 18. To find out more information, visit the Web Talk Guys website at webtalkguys.com/workshop. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
Web Talk Guys, downloading.
Web Talk Guys, buffering.
Thank you for listening to Web Talk Guys Radio, and my name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. The world is going wireless, with everyone getting connected and mobile. The use of mobile wireless devices is really changing how people interact socially, and this wave of change has yet to really impact America. Yet.
Yeah, the impacts have already had a dramatic effect in Asia and Europe because of the rapid deployment and adoption of wireless communication technology. We are not going to discuss the technology of wireless, but its impacts on how people act and behave when you have large groups of interconnected smart mobs using data-driven communications, not just voice. And it's changing the face of human interaction now and in the future.
To explain to us what smart mobs are, is our guest, Howard Rheingold, author of the new book, Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. Howard's the world's foremost authority on social implications of technology. He's also the author of a couple of books, The Virtual Community, which was named to Business Week's Best Business Books of the Year list, and Virtual Reality. And he also wrote Tools for Thought. His research for smart mobs took him around the world. You can always read more about smart mobs at smartmobs.com.
Howard, it's great to have you on the show with us.
My pleasure.
We gave a little quick tease on what your new book's all about, but give us your definition of a smart mob.
Well, smart mob is really about a social practice of a group of people that is enabled by an emerging technology.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing the PC, the internet, and the telephone merging, and we're beginning to see people using mobile communication and the internet to mobilize and coordinate their actions in the real world,
mm-hmm.
coordinate collective actions. So those are smart mobs. Now, it probably helps to give a few examples because collective action is a big term that maybe we can talk about at a little greater length. But
mm-hmm.
I first noticed young people and then eventually the whole population in places like Japan and in Scandinavia looking at their telephones more than they were listening to them.
Yeah.
That's this text messaging where you use your thumb to send a message and it arrives instantaneously on the screen of the other telephone.
Mm-hmm.
It's like instant messaging on the desktop computer, except it's with you on your telephone.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of have to explain that to Americans because it's new here.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
There's 100 billion text messages sent monthly worldwide, so it's big elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I looked into what these teenagers were doing, I was told, and this was curious, that the adults were using the term flocking to describe the way teenagers in Asia and in Europe all show up at the same place at the same time from eight different directions.
Wow.
Because they've coordinated through these messages. And then when I read that in the Philippines, over 1 million Philippine citizens had demonstrated peacefully and had in fact brought down the corrupt Estrada regime,
mm-hmm.
all organized by text messages, I realized that there was a connection here, and Smart Mob really grew out of that, the idea that people are now able to coordinate their activities,
mm-hmm.
even if they don't know each other, on a basis of a group of teenagers or 1 million citizens,
mm-hmm.
in ways that they weren't able to before.
Now, the term that you use, mob, that kind of has a little bit of a negative connotation to it to refer to, like organized crime or something like that. Is that part of what you're saying here, too? Is there kind of a positive side and a negative side to?
Yes. Well, this is actually true of every technology. After all, the printing press enabled the Bible and Mein Kampf to be printed. Telephone certainly is useful to people who don't have social benefits in mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is about groups of people being able to amplify their ability to cooperate, to act in the real world.
Okay.
I think that there are great opportunities here, but there are also some pitfalls. We are already seeing mobs that are not so democratic or nonviolent. The Nigerian riots last week over the Miss World competition that was held there.
Mm-hmm.
200 people died. Many people were summoned to those riots using text messages.
Oh,
think about a text message as opposed to a phone call or a regular old telephone tree mm-hmm. for organizing.
Mm-hmm.
Is you can send a message to someone and they can instantaneously forward it to everyone in their telephone's address book. So it can spread the word much more explosively through a crowd. We will see unruly mobs as well as democratic demonstrations and mm-hmm. criminals and terrorists and totalitarian governments. They will have their ability to cooperate amplified as well. So I wanted this to be a critical look mm-hmm. at both the opportunities and some of the pitfalls.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual functionality of how this works and how large groups like this can communicate to each other rapidly. What's the technology that they're using on the phone?
Well, you know, as I said, we're seeing a merger of Internet technology mm-hmm. where digital bits travel through networks the way packets do mm-hmm. on the Internet with wireless communication technologies. And there are several of those beyond the old cellular that we used for our voice communications. We're beginning to see some of these third-generation networks emerging in the U.S. You can get an account that gives you a high-speed wireless connection to your mm-hmm. PDA or mm-hmm. your telephone. You can download your email or do instant messaging or surf the web. Also in Europe, in South America, and Asia, they have these connections as well. And we will see more of that. Mm-hmm. Now, this not only enables you to send these text messages and to have clearer voice calls and to route your voice calls more effectively, it enables you to do what you could do with the Internet, which is to access information that's mm-hmm. advantageous to you. Mm-hmm. So we're already beginning to see, for example, that fishermen in the Arabian Gulf are getting text messages about which port has the best price for their fish today. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a mixture of mobility, having this in your pocket, and being able to have access not just to people to call, but to information that you can access. We're even seeing people updating their websites, their web blog, mobily, and with pictures. To update a picture to the web means that we're going to see a kind of peer-to-peer journalism emerging. We already are.
Now, how do large groups of people find this information or get this information, or is it just like a domino effect that one person shares it with three other people and then they share it with three other people?
Now, I think I should emphasize that we're really just seeing the first baby steps.
And yeah.
If we remember the PC when it first came out, the late 1970s, it was a pretty puny thing. You mm-hmm. can hold something in your hand today that's 1,000 times more powerful
yeah.
than the first PCs at a fifth of the price, and it's got a much, much faster connection than the first modems were. So mm-hmm. we're only beginning to see ways that people can connect the way they do on the Internet with people they may not know, but with whom they share an interest.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in New York, there's a service called UPOC.com. If you're interested in stalking celebrities, there's a celebrity watch where someone mm-hmm. spots a celebrity. They send a message to that group, and everyone who subscribed to that group gets that text message.
Oh, okay.
Or there's one called NYC Terrorist Alert. When I was there in November 2001, I was walking down the street. My pocket buzzed. I picked out my phone, and I saw that there's a message that said that an airplane had gone down off of JFK. Now, I went and changed my airline reservations that afternoon to train reservations because I didn't know how long the airport would be closed.
Hmm.
In Brazil, there are 400,000 young people essentially flirting with each other because you can get a service for your telephone that gives you a screen name and a profile and enables you to search for people who have a similar profile in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
That's another aspect to this, is location awareness. Our devices already know where we are. Just even an ordinary cell phone knows where you are. So very quickly, we will be able to go to a new town and say to our telephone or our PDA, I don't know where I am. How do I get to Fifth and Main? Or is there a good Chinese restaurant in this direction? And simply point your device down the street. That's available in a limited form here and now, but we will begin to see people communicating with others who they may not know, who are nearby, but with whom they have some shared interests, mm-hmm. just as we can connect on the Internet with people who are not nearby.
Yeah.
Now, Howard, when you were talking earlier about flocking, and I think you had a kind of a funny little scenario that you observed where kids collaborated about train schedules.
That's in Sweden. Here's another example. People can use this to cheat the system. In Sweden, on the subways, it's on the honor system. You buy a ticket, but you don't have to run it through any kind of machine to get out. There are spot checks by transit police who check at certain stations at certain times randomly when you're leaving the station. So these kids in Stockholm, they send each other messages. They send through a central server. You send a message saying the transit police are at a certain stop right now. And so people avoid that. So, again, here's a way of cheating the system, cooperating
yeah.
to cheat the system.
It's
a classic arms race. But, you know, when I say collective action, big things happen when people are able to cooperate in a new level. eBay is a great example of that. A market that shouldn't exist because the buyer and the seller are hundreds or thousands of miles apart. There's a reputation system that makes that work.
Mm-hmm.
Part of Smart Mobs is talking about how reputation systems might enable us to connect with people we don't know but might have common cause with.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also Napster. 70 million people put their computers together to create this giant jukebox. Or SETI at home.
Mm-hmm.
2 million people amassed 20 trillion computing operations per second of computing power to search for signals in outer space just by enabling your computer to share the computation with others on a collective basis.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are using those computer cycles to help medical scientists study the immune system, something called folding at home that studies protein folding.
Mm.
So if you imagine that the devices we hold in our hands now are going to be 1,000 times more powerful,
yeah,
10 years from now, we'd have billions of devices, thousands of times more powerful, communicating at very rapid speeds. We'll be able to have these supercomputing collectives, these file-sharing collectives. What will they be able to do mm-hmm. that we can't do now?
Your book really focuses on about the changes in human behavior, and I know we haven't talked a lot about that yet. You talk about amplifying human cooperation. Where is that going to take us, and is there a risk of individuals losing their separateness from this? I mean, as we become more interconnected and networked, you know, I keep having this analogy in my head about Star Trek and the Borg and how,
yes,
how everybody's interconnected and sharing information, but it basically eliminates that individual from standing out from the group.
Those are two questions. The big picture here about cooperation is that every time humans are able to solve the collective action dilemma,
yeah,
which is the individual self-interest versus a group being able to build something in common that enriches them all, what we call a commonwealth. Big things happen in the way society changes. Humans hunted and gathered, hunted rabbits, dug up carrots for a long time in small family groups.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, those groups got together into larger units and self-organized hunting big game.
Mm-hmm.
And then agriculture, and then the printing press made the collective enterprises of science and democracy possible. So,
mm-hmm,
every time there is a way, a communication technology, and some new social contract enables us to organize collective action, society becomes more complex. There seems to be a trade-off. Every communication technology connects people in new ways and alienates them in
mm-hmm.
new ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that with the telephone, we've seen that with the internet, with email. Both of these things bring benefits, and both of them, I think, bring conflict as well. In terms of being on all the time, I think there's a philosophical question about, is that a way that humans want to spend our lives, always being connected to others, never being alone? And I think that the answer to that question largely depends on how old you are.
Yeah.
We've got a generation around the world of 15-year-olds, and they're in Brazil, and they're in Korea, and they are in Turkey or in Sweden. They're very comfortable carrying devices that enable them to summon their social network or to get information that gives them a competitive advantage at the
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 10 years from now, they're going to be 25. They're going to be entering the workforce. They're going to be citizens. Their devices are going to be thousands of times more powerful. That's going to make a big change on the world, and a kind of change in individuality and community, whether it's Borg-like or community-like or markets on a whole new level, I think will be quite significant
mm-hmm.
because of that generational comfort with being always connected and always having a device that can summon other people.
I've had a cell phone for probably 12 years or more, and one of the big things that people always said was, you know, I can always turn that phone off, and I don't have to be available all the time. But it almost seems like what this is you're basically available to your community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, you probably can turn it off, but I guess, is that going to be a socially acceptable thing to do?
In societies where people have been using this technology, not just the mobile telephony, but the texting, people keep their phones on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that has to do with the way operators market it. If you get charged when you receive a call and you receive a message, you're going to keep your phone off. And that's one of the things that has retarded the growth of this medium in
yeah.
the U.S.
Sure.
In other parts of the world, you don't pay if you receive a message. That's changing here, and I think we'll see the growth of that. Situations in which it is rude or inconvenient to make a voice telephone call, you can send a text message.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got these Japanese kids whose houses are very small, can't really have private conversations with their friends in their household. They can now communicate with their peers without their parents hearing. That's a big kind of generational change in Japan. Any place where it's inconvenient to talk, but you need to communicate a message, texting provides that opportunity, so more people keep their phones on more of the time.
Is the United States in a competitive disadvantage right now if you look at how advanced Europe is and Asia is and how they're adopting this wireless technology and always connectivity? And we're just not there. And is there some concern?
I think that the U.S. could become a technological backwater in the mobile revolution in some ways. We really led the world with the PC mm-hmm. and again with the Internet. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that 19-year-old Harvard dropout Bill Gates.
Yeah.
A lot of the PC and a lot of the Internet were created by amateurs, by mm-hmm. users, by young people. In the U.S., those folks have been slow to be enabled to get onto this, whether it's because of the way these things have been marketed or priced. I think we're seeing some regulatory challenges. The way the FCC regulates spectrum is being challenged by some emerging mm-hmm. radio wireless technologies. If mm-hmm. the U.S. continues to favor the existing way of awarding frequencies to particular players, usually big broadcasters in particular areas, rather than treating more of the spectrum as a commons that many different broadcasters can share, and another country decides to deregulate their spectrum, we may see the U.S. fall behind. So mm-hmm. Smart Labs is also about a political conflict that cuts through all of these technologies and practices about open systems versus closed systems. Existing business models, the Motion Picture Association, the recording industry, desperately trying to protect their existing business model against disruptive technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Or technologies that come along and make yesterday's business models obsolete.
Yeah.
These conflicts are being embodied in some legislation and regulatory battles that are happening right now.
We need to take a quick break, but more with Howard Rheingold and Smart Mobs in a moment. This is Web Talk Eyes Radio. Do you have a website that's feeling a little lonely? Well, you might need a good dose of marketing and promotions. Come join the Web Talk Guys at a one-day workshop, March 18. We'll help you understand the successful components of a marketing plan for an e-business, and we'll also cover sponsored links, search engine optimization, submission and ranking, reciprocal links, building an affiliate program, newsletters, the media, usability, and all kinds of techniques. The workshop is held at the Tacoma Community College's Downtown Center in Tacoma, Washington, and it runs from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Tuesday, March 18. To find out more information, visit the Web Talk Guys website at webtalkguys.com/workshop. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
Web Talk Radio is back. I'm Rob Greenlee, and I'm here with Web Girl Dana.
And joining us on the phone is Howard Rheingold. He's been talking with us about his new book, Smart Mobs. Howard, you commented on the record industry a couple of minutes ago. What's your feeling about these Napster-like sharing communities, and are they part of the collective mobs you're talking about?
Napster was about 70 million people deciding they wanted to distribute their music digitally and shop around for it.
Yeah.
Now, the problem that the recording industry has is that those people weren't paying for that music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are technologies that would enable artists to be paid. We could either have something like what enables people to hear music on the radio. Everybody pays a little bit of a tax on their device. Right now, you pay a tax on recording tape, or you pay when you buy a radio. Mm-hmm. And that money goes into a pool that's distributed to artists. Another way of doing it is micropayments. I might be able to put my books out and enable people to buy them for a penny a page. The recording industry, they would like to protect their monopoly on distribution.
Yeah.
They are sponsoring legislation that would require a kind of digital rights management that could really stifle innovation in the future. It would mandate chips being put into devices, not just mm-hmm. music players, but video recorders and computers, that would block future 19-year-old Harvard dropouts from modifying mm-hmm. their software. It would only be authorized content that we could run on these devices. I think there are better ways to do this. The Hollings Bill, by the way, you mm-hmm. can find out more about that at EFF.org. That's some of the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Berman Bill would allow the recording industry to essentially hack peer-to-peer networks to prevent people from stealing music.
Mm. Wow.
That might also prevent people from contributing their computers to help cure cancer. I think there are better solutions to the intellectual property problem. What these solutions are from the motion picture industry, the recording industry, they're really about control of a new medium.
Certainly seems like the smart mob technology really relies on smart devices, and smart devices always equate back to computing power. is the Pocket PC, do you think, from Microsoft, really the perfect device for moving forward with the smart mob technology?
You're going to want a larger screen and more computing power and a better keyboard for mm-hmm. some applications, and the mm-hmm. Pocket PC has a place there. The most largely used technology in the world is the telephone, and the mobile phone reaches people who don't use PCs. 1 in 8 people in Botswana have mobile phones. So I think we're going to see that of the Pocket PCs, they're going to gain telephone capabilities. Mm-hmm. But more and more, we're going to see our telephones gaining computational capabilities. And I think in terms of the input device mm-hmm. that the young people around the world use, it's the thumb. They are very, very accustomed
yeah,
to
sure.
using the thumb to send in messages. So we're seeing a kind of divide between the old hands who want to use computers and keyboards and the new hands who want to use telephones and keypads.
Do you see both devices moving forward in the future, or are we going to see one integrated device?
I think we will see an ecology of devices. We will okay. have an integrated device. It's a telephone that has significant computing capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
For some people who really need to access their desktop documents, we're going to see handheld mm-hmm. computer devices.
Howard, please tell us where we can learn more about smart mobs on the web and where your book is available.
The book is available at your local bookstore or at Amazon or Barnes & Noble online, or you can go to smartmobs.com for information about the book. And it's also an ongoing weblog, so every day there's more information for people who have read the book but want to keep up with what's going on with smart mob technology.
Oh, terrific. Howard, it was fantastic having you on the show with us.
My pleasure.
It's a really fascinating topic, and I think it's something that everybody in the U.S. is going to know more about very soon.
Great. Good.
We've been speaking with Howard Rheingold about his new book, Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. This is Web Talk Eyes Radio.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.